somewhat outraged that the post office is moving this way when all across this country we're having economic hardships and they're about to add additional.
Alaska's congressional delegation works against the bypass mail increase. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 6th of March. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar plans a visit to Alaska.
We have huge interests as American citizens in the Alaskan landscape and its wilderness and its oil and gas resources.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Fostering safe, connected schools is a foundation for academic achievement through annual school climate surveys. Information at aasb.org. Support for APRN coverage of Iditarod 2009 comes from Spinard Builders, supplying Devo paints, adding color and life to your home.
A grand jury has indicted Fraser Verusio, one of Don Young's former congressional staffers, on corruption charges for taking a free trip to the 2003 World Series. Prosecutors have charged Verusio, who worked under Young when the congressman chaired the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Officials say Verusio and another Capitol Hill staffer accepted an illegal gratuity when lobbyists gave them an all-expense-paid trip to New York, including the World Series game and a visit to a strip club. The indictment charges Verusio helped the lobbyists get favorable language for an equipment rental company into a federal highway bill. The indictment is the latest in the investigation surrounding criminal activity by former lobbyist Jack Abramoff. State legislators attending the Energy Council in Washington, D.C. say they were surprised to hear that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, is taking a heightened awareness in what they had considered Alaska-only issues. In particular, the in-state Bullet gas line that would deliver natural gas to the Rail Belt and South Central. Speaking by teleconference from Washington, Anchorage Senator Liesl McGuire says FERC staff and commissioners told the Alaskans that the commission had recently announced its plan of regulating the ConocoPhillips liquefied natural gas facility on the Kenai. And she says that will make a huge difference in developing a bullet line. She says the regulatory landscape changed with the National Energy Act of 2005.
There's this section in there, Section 7, that talks about pipes leading into and feeding LNG facilities also being under their jurisdiction. They didn't know the answer. They said it would be a question of first impression for them. So, you know, that was eye-opening to realize that there's a very real chance that the in-state pipeline that's being built could be regulated in part by FERC.
She says federal involvement will have implications for the in-state project by making the same requirements as the pipeline through Canada.
So all of the requirements that FERC has, the pre-application, application process, the site selection and testing, certainly the issue of firm transportation commitments, all of FERC's regular rules and procedures would apply.
The Kenai plant will appeal the FERC decision, and McGuire says the legislature will likely ask for an advisory opinion on the gas line project. Harry Noah, the administration's project manager for the in-state line, says FERC dealt with the issue several years ago with the Yukon Pacific project and found federal regulation was not required. He says he will meet with the Alaska legislators when they return. Alaska's congressional delegation is warning that the upcoming increase on postal rates will have devastating consequences in rural Alaska. Postal post rates are going up across the country on May 11th. That increase will be most dramatic for bypass mail customers and will amount to a 50% increase for the largest packages. Now Representative Don Young and Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich are asking the United States Postmaster to consider a plan that would soften the blow. For member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has the story.
The new parcel post rates will affect every size package, but those increases will be more noticeable for larger packages. Darris May is the manager of marketing for the Post Office Alaska District.
In general, as you get to the higher weights, your increase is a higher percentage.
Over 100 million pounds of those larger size packages make their way to remote Alaska communities through bypass mail. That's a system that allows private air carriers to bypass the postal system and deliver parcel mail directly to stores and consumers. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says rural Alaskans rely on bypass mail for almost everything that can't be brought in during the short barge season.
We don't have the transportation system, the federal highway system that has been built out in the lower 48 that connects many communities so that goods and services can move across state lines.
Because of that, Alaska's congressional delegation is concerned that the impacts of the postal increase will hit rural Alaskans harder than anyone else. Again, Senator Murkowski.
It would be absolutely devastating to people out in rural Alaska who rely on bypass mail to keep the costs of their goods that are flown out to their communities, to keep them within control.
Her Democratic colleague, Senator Mark Begich, says he sees the same problem.
I'm somewhat outraged that the post office is moving this way when all across this country we're having economic hardships, and they're about to add additional. I think that's just outrageous.
And Congressman Don Young says now would be the worst time for such an increase.
This is a scary part about it, because with the high cost of fuel, high cost of energy, then you add a 40% increase on postal rates, it'd be very bad at this time.
The post office loses about $7 million a year on bypass mail. May says the new rates will still amount to a subsidy for rural Alaskans, and she says it's all part of a comprehensive price strategy.
The rate increase is not about Bush, Alaska. It's across the nation.
But Begich argues that the post office doesn't have to make money in every region because it's a national system. He adds that the proposal was drafted when oil prices were on the rise and headed towards record levels.
You know, these are all started last year, and it's kind of moved through the process, and here we are today. You know, the fuel cost for aviation has dropped by almost 50%, and yet they haven't adjusted any of their increase requests, which I think is somewhat amazing, because part of the argument they make is fuel has gone up.
Murkowski, Begich, and Young have sent a joint letter to U.S. Postmaster Jack Potter. They are urging that he consider an alternative proposal. That proposal was first offered by the mainline carriers in Alaska, including Everett's, Linden, Northern, and Alaska Airlines. Those airlines are saying that the increase puts the whole bypass system in risk of collapse. They are all asking that the per-pound rate charged for a 70-pound item be applied across the board, even to much smaller units of only a few pounds. Senator Murkowski says that would be a fair compromise.
Basically, what this would do is it would still provide, or still allow for, a rate increase, but it would be at about 17% instead of 50%.
But the increase is already scheduled to go into effect, and the public comment period quietly passed on March 2nd. In the past, enormous hike proposals have come up only to be reduced at the last minute. Last year, bypass rates increased 12% only after they were scheduled to jump by almost 40%. Congressman Young fought against those massive increases with former Senator Ted Stevens. Stevens is credited with creating the bypass mail system. Young now says this congressional team will be doing all they can to reduce the impact this go-around.
And we have to convince the post office that this is what's necessary, and I think we'll be successful. You know, in this business, you never make promises because they've come back to bite you. But we're going to sure work hard on it. I know the two senators are going to work equally as hard to do it.
Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, on the eve of the Anchorage start of the Iditarod, John Little talks up the racers.
I was running through a sort of a top 10 list, and I couldn't cram 17 mushers into the top 10. It's pretty loaded on the front end.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska. BP is focused on the future, getting more oil out of Prudhoe Bay and bringing Alaska's gas to North America. The University of Alaska Fairbanks now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
U.S. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar says he'll visit Alaska next month, but only the state's largest city. The Interior Department is holding hearings in four states on offshore oil and gas development. One will be in Anchorage, with others in San Francisco, New Orleans, and Atlantic City. Salazar met this week with about 20 Alaska natives in Washington who are opposed to drilling near their villages. Some of them invited him to visit Barrow and perhaps hold a hearing there, but Salazar says that won't be possible this visit.
We are going to be as inclusive as we can in the process by inviting all the affected communities to come to the meetings that we're having. We will be in Alaska, I think, for a total of 24 hours or so. And so I'm not exactly sure. In fact, I know that on this trip we won't be going up north. This is going to be a trip that'll take us into Anchorage, and that's about as far as we'll go this time.
Salazar put a last-minute Bush administration plan to open up more of America's waters to offshore development on hold last month. He called it a headlong rush of the worst kind and said it was tilted toward usual energy players, while American consumers and renewable energy companies were overlooked. He called for next month's hearings as an opportunity to hear from communities in the heart of the offshore drilling debate. Salazar says even if he doesn't get to Barrow and other northern villages next month, he does plan to return to Alaska, which is affected by many of the Interior Department's decisions.
Alaska is a huge part of the United States of America. We have huge interests as American citizens in the Alaskan landscape and its wilderness and its oil and gas resources and much of what Alaska has to offer. And so we will be taking additional trips into Alaska, and at some point hopefully we'll make it up to the north.
Last month, Salazar added an additional 180 days for public comment on the proposed five-year drilling plan. He also gave the Minerals Management Service 45 days to put together a report on all of the offshore resources in U.S. waters. It will cover not only oil and gas, but renewable energy too, like wave and wind power. That report is due in a few weeks' time. Thanks to tourist promotions, most Anchorage residents are aware they are living a big, wild life. But how does the city fare in an assessment of quality of life indicators? A study released yesterday gives mixed reviews. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
The report is entitled Envision Anchorage, and its creators expect it to serve the same purpose as its 2006 predecessor.
It gave us the information and the inspiration to work as partners and create community plans that make change where it's needed most.
Michelle Brown is president of the United Way of Anchorage. United Way helped coordinate the 18-member committee that put together this second assessment in a continuing appraisal process. Brown says that the 2006 assessment showed community groups and agencies needed to combine their efforts to help at-risk youth. The latest report indicates some successes.
Anchorage United for Youth has already made an impact. Mentoring is up. More of our youth are having supportive adults they can count on. Youth in the juvenile justice system are all now screened for substance use problems and mental health issues. And teen arrests are down.
Arrests of 10 through 19-year-olds dropped by nearly 25% between 2003 and 2007. However, the assessment also showed graduation rates remain fairly static. About one-third of Anchorage students are still not graduating on time. That's better than the state average, but below the national average of approximately 75% graduation. Joel Gilbertson, Chief Strategy and Administration Officer for Providence Health and Services Alaska, said report statistics show the health community needs to focus more on obesity.
In Anchorage, overweight and obesity rates exceed the national average. From 2003 to 2007, the rate of Anchorage residents who were obese increased by 4%. During that same period, the local overweight rate is up 2.7%. Both of these trends are well above national levels.
Anchorage's Health and Human Services Director, Diane Engel, presented a graph showing some employment challenges for Anchorage.
What we see here, unfortunately, is that the percentage of adults aged 25 to 54 who are employed full-time has decreased during the last 5 years. And it's decreased at a rate twice that of the national average.
While in Anchorage, overall household income has risen, housing has some ominous statistics. Engel said the federal government considers housing that costs over 30% of a household's net income as not really affordable. It puts the household at risk if an income loss occurs, or if illness or a major expense strikes.
In 2008, 44% of Anchorage survey respondents spent more than the recommended amount on housing, some spending as much as 75% of their take-home pay.
The report showed nearly one-fifth of Anchorage households spent at least 50% of their net income on housing. The somewhat good news is that those percentages did not worsen from 2006 to 2008, perhaps due in part to somewhat stable housing costs in Anchorage. Primary information for the assessment was gathered via phone surveys. Secondary data came from various agencies and government departments. While the random phone surveys followed accepted scientific procedure, inadvertently, 75% of the respondents were Caucasian and around 50% were in households of only one or two individuals. Brown said a broader racial and ethnic base would be included in the next comprehensive report to be released in 2010. A copy of the Envision Anchorage Assessment 2008 report is available on the United Way of Anchorage website. This is Len Anderson.
Across the state, Alaska's unemployment rate reached 7.9% in January, slightly higher than the national rate for the same month. The Alaska rate is more than a percentage point higher than December. State Labor Department economist Dan Robinson says the rise is partly due to annual processing revisions. Revised data from a previous calendar year doesn't strictly compare to rates in the current year. But Robinson says Alaska is feeling the impact of the national and global economic downturn.
Because we're not yet seeing big job losses through January, at least, it's more likely due to what's happening in the lower 48 and the world.
Robinson says Alaska often has a higher unemployment rate due to the seasonality of many jobs.
The unemployment rate has climbed during periods of job growth and in fairly healthy economic times for Alaska. And it's fallen when we've really been struggling. So the unemployment rate alone can be misleading.
Payroll data indicates Alaska is still adding jobs. 5,200 more people were employed in the state this January than in January 2008. Robinson says one reason is Alaska's industry mix.
A lot of the job losses nationally were in industries that Alaska doesn't have much of. Michigan is really struggling because the auto industry losses. We don't make cars in Alaska. And even our construction industry is not going through the same kind of things the national construction industry is in terms of real reduction.
The number of people without jobs in Juneau reached 7% in January and more than 10% in Ketchikan. The jobless rate in Fairbanks was nearly 9%. The North Slope borough is the only area of the state where unemployment fell slightly over the past year to 4% in January. The state labor department says unemployment is highest in southwest Alaska. Sixty-seven teams are preparing for tomorrow's ceremonial Iditarod start in downtown Anchorage. The real thousand-mile race to Nome begins Sunday in Willow. The field is significantly smaller than last year, when 96 teams started the race. John Little is a Kasilof musher who is a veteran of both the Yukon Quest and the Iditarod. John, everyone is talking about the course conditions. It sounds like there is a lot of snow out there. What have you heard?
You know what? That's the one thing I haven't heard a lot about, except the mushers are talking about deep snow and having to camp more often because it takes longer to get from point A to point B. And they don't want to run their dogs more than 8 hours before stopping because the dogs just will slow down if they push too hard and go too far. And I think it's a good problem to have. I'd rather have slow, deep snow than thin snow and ice and things that can wreck sleds and break ribs and things like that.
Are there any particular mushers who might benefit especially from a snowy course?
Yes. Team Norway is going to be pretty happy. They don't have a rocket-fast team. In fact, Bjorn R. Anderson told me this summer that he really enjoys the southern route because it's got more hills and it's just a little slower and it suits his team better. So I would think the snow probably would help him. And it's the teams that can grind it out. Mitch Seavey always has a team that can just power through deep snow.
And are there other factors that you think could be a big influence on this year's race?
Oh, well, there's always something, and that's the fun of running the race, is something comes up. Haven't had a storm for a while. But I think the trail's going to be pretty good from what little I've heard. It hasn't been warm. We've had some decent snow. I would expect a fairly normal trail, if maybe just a little slow.
It's a small field this year. Are there any big-name mushers missing from the lineup?
Not that I'm aware of. It looks like the usuals are there. You know, I was running through a sort of a top 10 list, and I couldn't cram, 17 mushers into the top 10. It's pretty loaded on the front end.
Lance Mackey is the two-time defending champion, but he had run the Yukon Quest right before both previous wins in the Iditarod. Do you think he'll be unstoppable this year, given that he opted not to compete in the Quest?
Well, no one is unstoppable, but Lance has shown that he has an incredible team and he is an incredible leader. He knows how to run dogs, so he is, if you're making a top three list, he's going to be on it. Missing the Quest, I don't know if that's going to be a factor. Somehow I think that he'll be right up there one way or the other.
I've heard people say that the trail conditions could be problematic this year. The Serum Run folks had to turn back, for example, because there was such deep snow. And there are reports that people aren't traveling out in the country as much, both because of economic conditions and culturally. People just aren't out trapping as much as they used to. Does this have an influence in how the Iditarod runs? Has it in the past, and do you think it may this year?
Yes, that's news to me, and it makes sense. If gas has been expensive and people aren't traveling as much between villages, that the trail's going to be slower. Very much could be a factor. But they've had slowed trails in the past. I remember when Robert Sorley won in 2005, he was just slogging through nasty, deep snow, and he still won. So I guess it remains to be seen. I guess if people turned back, I don't know where they turn back. I don't think that's going to happen here. I think the Iditarod has a pretty good trail breaking crew, and the caliber of mushers is pretty good. Some of them may have to break out their snowshoes. That would be incredible if that would be the first time probably since the first race that somebody's had to break trail for their dogs.
John Little is an Iditarod veteran. He says this year he'll be monitoring the race from his home in Kisilov. Aaron Peck of Alberta, Canada, will be the first official musher out of the chute on this year's Iditarod Trail sled dog race. The drawing was held last night at the Mushers' annual banquet in Anchorage. While Peck is the first racer in the draw, he'll actually be the second sled out. Going first will be honorary mushers Rod and Carol Udd. Two-time defending champion Lance Mackey drew the number 47 slot. The last in the draw is Jeff Holt of North Pole.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
The Coast Guard called in a special strike team to prevent oil, fuel, and other pollutants from leaking out of a grounded vessel in the Pribilofs. The 112-foot Margun went aground on the north side of St. George Island Thursday morning in a particularly sensitive area. The vessel is stuck on Staria Beach near fur seal and sea lion rookeries and haulouts, as well as an ancient Aleut village site with marine mammal bones dating back 2,500 years. The island also hosts numerous seabird rookeries. Coast Guard Petty Officer Sarah Francis says they called in the National Strike Force team from California because they could respond more quickly than the commercial salvage team from Unalaska, and because they have special training to deal with pollution and environmental hazards. The ship has at least 15,000 gallons of fuel and 668 gallons of lube oil on board.
They'll assess the situation when they arrive on board and determine what tanks are best accessed and which tanks have what quantities of fuel and how stable the vessel is. That's our first mission. And from there, they can determine what tactics they'll be using to actually remove the oil.
The team has arrived on St. George Island and plans on using pumps and hoses to remove the pollutants tomorrow morning. Salvager Dan Magone is also on scene today and is helping move fuel to a less vulnerable part of the vessel. He reported damage to the Margun's hull and a minor sheen on the water to the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is trying to complete the work quickly while the weather is still good. World Wildlife Fund Managing Director Margaret Williams says swift action by the Coast Guard on the biologically diverse island was necessary and commendable, especially given the importance of the fur seal habitat.
And the fur seals have been on a steady population decline over the last decade, and any type of additional risk, any type of stress, such as an oil spill, could just be another serious blow to that population.
Williams says St. George tribal government also responded quickly to another serious threat.
People often don't think of rat spills as being something that even comes with a shipwreck, but you get a bunch of rats on a bird island like the Pribilofs, and you can just say farewell to birds after that.
The tribal government quickly placed rat traps around the area and are monitoring for evidence of rats. Rats eat bird eggs and young and can even kill adults. The state ferry Lituya resumed sailing yesterday. The vessel has been out of service since it blew away from Metlakatla in late January and grounded on nearby rocks. Hull and other repairs were completed earlier this week at Alaska Ship and Dry Dock in Ketchikan. The ferry sails 5 days per week between Metlakatla and Ketchikan. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We'd love to hear your comments about the show. To send us your thoughts, go to APRN.org, scroll down to the bottom of the page, and click on the Contact Us link. Be sure to tell us if we can use your comments on the air, and if so, how to pronounce your name. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Rebecca Shear in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster. Duncan Moon is our vice president for media production. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. And by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, helping you reach educational savings goals. Save in Alaska, study anywhere. Information at 1-888-4-ALASKA. This message sponsored by the UA College Savings Plan. Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo goes the distance for the Iditarod, an event that brings people together in the spirit of Alaska's heritage. Wells Fargo, the next stage.